And welcome everyone to a brand new episode of the DKB or WrestlingObserver.com and F4WOnline.com. I am, of course, as always, your host, Alan, and I am joined this week by a man I'm very excited to have on the show with me because he is coming out of podcast hibernation. He's a man I haven't spoken to on the podcast airwaves in quite a while. He hasn't done one of his own podcasts in quite a while, but we lured him out with the promise of a free show for the masses to hear his voice. And that is one Mr. Dave Musgrave, a podcast legend, I don't mind saying, Dave. Pleased to have you on here.
Yeah, it's great to be on. I always love doing shows with you, and it's been far, far too long. For this show or any other for me, really. So,
Dave, I'm so excited to have you on. I'll even be able to have enthusiasm despite the frustrations of the last hour of our lives as we've been dealing with technical difficulties here. Dave is not only a great guest to have on your podcast, a great man, but he is a patient man, and it was just the kind of patience I needed to deal with me and my issues I was having here. So, Dave, thank you for that.
I was thinking we were going to see that, like, 350-man tournament in Europe before we were going to see this podcast actually being recorded.
I wouldn't bank on that. Well, Dave, the reason you're here, the reason I have you on, the reason it's a free show is because we are resuming the I Was There When series. And if anyone is not familiar with that concept, if you're listening to this because it's a free show and you don't usually check out the DKB, we did a show back in the spring. It was the first of a series where we had Brendan Quinn on talking about the famous four-way in Chikara at King of Trios 2009 between Kota Ibushi, El Generico, Jigsaw, and Nick Jackson, a very famous U.S. indie match which he was there for. And the premise behind this series is talking about famous or just really great pro wrestling matches that our guest was there to experience live, that they saw with their own two eyes in person, in the flesh. And this week, since it is a free show, and since Dave has just such a wide array of great matches that I wanted to discuss with him, we couldn't do just one. We got to do both. But really, the main reason for that is I just like talking to Dave. So we're going to do two of his matches that he has seen that I think are a great contrast to one another. We will start with one, and we won't mention what the other is. We'll come to that later on in the show. But the big one we're going to start with, Dave, is WWF 2002, about a month or two before they got the E out, so it is still WWF, Toronto Sky Dome, WrestleMania 18, and of course, it is the very famous Hulk Hogan versus The Rock. I won't let you make your gag that you made on the first time we tried recording, Dave. It was not Edge and Booker T. Hulk Hogan and Rock. No matter how much you want to talk about the shampoo commercial, we're talking Hogan Rock, and we're talking that incredible, memorable match that people still talk about to this day, and I'm guessing it left quite an impact on you.
Yeah, it was just one of the most incredible things I could ever be there for. I can't even describe what the building was like, how it was just shaking. And so I had an advantage and a disadvantage for this match. The disadvantage I had was, try to think how far you are from the middle of the Sky Dome, being in Dublin, Ireland.
Pretty far.
I could
probably bike it.
Yeah. So that's only slightly further away than I was from the ring. I was basically third row from the back in the Sky Dome. So that was a disadvantage visually, but I can tell you that I think that actually gave me advantage for feeling like the power of the building shaking.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
It is something. I know there have been occasions where I've been at shows, not quite in stadiums that big, but on shows we were able to move around a little bit more, and I've wandered as far back up as I can to just kind of take in everything. That is a special kind of feel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I was in the same building. I was in the Sky Dome for the first UFC Toronto show, and what's his name? Mark Hominick, I think his name is. He was facing Jose Aldo.
Yeah.
And and there was quite a – it was a pretty powerful thing, but, I mean, it was – there's no comparison to what I experienced with Hogan versus Rock.
Now, Dave, I want to get a little bit of personal to start this. So what we did with Brendan when he was on, and we'll do the same here, is talk a little about where you were at as a fan in terms of before going to the show, what your interests were, what this show meant to you. Obviously, logistically, as far as planning a show like this when it comes to a WrestleMania, I would think it's planned out quite a bit in advance, and this was something you had earmarked on your calendar for quite a while, with it being in your hometown.
Yeah, so it's I had moved up to Toronto from Nova Scotia about a year and a half before this, and I was really excited to go. It was like 2001 was just such a hot time for wrestling, and this, the fall of 2001 when the tickets went on sale. A friend of mine from work, I went with him. My cousin Paul went with me. I was living with my cousin Paul at the time, and I would drag him to shows. And a bunch of my friend Jeff's friends from Michigan came down. So there was probably about 15 of us at the show together in two sections of like 7 or 8 guys.
See, quite the crew.
Yeah, yeah, and all littering the outer rim of the building. What was really fun is that I met most of these guys that weekend, and we just had a blast. We partied the whole weekend. There was nothing else in town that weekend. We mentioned before when we started recording, this was pre-WrestleMania weekend cultural events that you have now.
Because 2004 was really the first time that there was the ROH show attached to it.
I mean, yeah, it was 2006 before that even really got going, because 2005 there was nothing.
Yeah, that's true, yeah. So 2002, it's interesting to think about, because in 2002, was there really anything else that could have run alongside WrestleMania? There was, Ring of Honor had just started, so there's no way they would have been in a position to hold Toronto.
They'd had one show at that point.
They had one show. TNA was, I don't think it started or were about to start.
Not till June.
Yeah, so there's no other strong indies. WCW is dead. ECW is dead.
And there's pretty much no strong Toronto groups either. Like Apocalypse Wrestling Federation was the closest, and I don't even know if they were still running at that point.
Isn't it crazy to think that there was a time that year of right before everyone popped up? Because if you think about it, TNA popped up, RH popped up, Chikara popped up, PWG popped up.
Yeah, the next year PWG came along.
There was that period around this WrestleMania where, I'd say a few months before, there was really nothing. There was smaller indies. IWA Mid-South were around. But
I remember there was an attempt at starting that group, MECW, which was apparently, looked like a fun show, but I heard it was horrible. And that was Joey Styles who said that, and he was the commentator, so.
Yeah, I forget the guy's name. That came out. I was talking to someone recently. I can't remember if he was even recording a show, but that same promotion came up. I was trying to remember the name of the guy. John Collins, that's it. John Collins was, I believe, the name behind MECW. I think he went AWOL or something, and no one could find him or something along those lines. But they certainly weren't running in Toronto.
No. So, yeah, So Access was running, but other than that, there was nothing wrestling related for us to do that weekend. The closest I came to something outside of Mania was that on the way to Mania from lunch, there was like a kind of a flea market kind of thing, and there was a bunch of old PWIs on it. So, coincidentally, which I almost bought, and I kind of wish I did, but I didn't. So,
As far as your fandom going into this, were you a huge WWF fan at the time? Were you maybe someone who was more of a fan in the 90s who had fallen out? Or where was your WWF fandom at this point?
Yeah, my wrestling fandom never died off, and WWE is what I was into at the time. I hadn't expanded it into international stuff. That was about a year away still. And I hadn't gotten into indie stuff because there wasn't a whole lot of that to be into. And that was coming about a year later as well. So I'd always been a huge fan, and I couldn't have been any more excited to be at this show. I often refer, I referred to it as the best night of my life. I am a married man now, and I do realize the protocol, as well as the actual truth, is to say that our wedding was the best night of my life. But up till then, this was the case.
Now, as a big WWF fan, obviously, WrestleMania is the show to go to. Was this your first WrestleMania? Did you maybe get to see WrestleMania 6 as a younger Dave Musgrave, or was this your first WrestleMania?
No, because this was definitely my first WrestleMania, and it was outside of, so there'd been in 1993. So again, I'm from Nova Scotia originally, which is quite, you know, right now living in Toronto area. I actually live closer to New York City than I do where I'm from. It would actually take me about 10 hours to drive to New York City as opposed to 21 hours to drive to my hometown. So,
Nova Scotia, East Coast or West Coast? Sorry.
For East Coast. It's very, very much the East Coast. It's pretty much my hometown is one of the most easterly points in mainland North America.
So that's Maritimes territory, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, so I never got to WrestleMania. I know many people who were there that I've met over the years, and I actually have one friend who was at WrestleMania 3, but that's a whole other story. You want to talk about a guy who you could have on the show. The biggest show I'd been to at this point, there was a WWF TV taping in my hometown in 1993. My biggest memory of that, the biggest event that happened on that was Mr. Hughes hitting the Undertaker with the urn. Besides that,
don't sell that short. That's a pretty big event.
Yeah. And
Mr.
then
Hughes going getting himself some.
Yeah, and the other big event on it was that some guy come out that we seemed like a jobber, and then he pinned Owen Hart, and it was Bastion Booger. It was his debut. Anyways, the biggest event I'd been to besides that was the ECW show at the Hershey Center in Mississauga, Ontario. And that was my first summer that I lived up here. Other than that, I hadn't been to anything that was significant.
So I'm putting myself in your shoes, or trying to kind of compare. I would say this sounds quite similar to when I went to my first WrestleMania in 2012 in Miami. And I know for me at that point, it was just awe and just, I can't believe I'm here. I can't believe I'm finally here. I can't believe I'm doing WrestleMania. This is WrestleMania. Oh my God. Those are
yeah,
the kind of feelings.
It's hard to believe it actually happened.
Yeah, exactly. Like at the time and for weeks after, it's like, was I actually at WrestleMania? This doesn't seem, when I watch it back, I remember when I was watching it back, specifically the Hell in a Cell match with Triple H and Undertaker, and I was just like, I wasn't actually there. I was like, but I was. And now I go to WrestleMania most years, and it's kind of like, it's not really that much of a shock to the system anymore, but it's still cool.
No.
It's not that amazing, I can't believe it's actually happening type thing. So, definitely your first WrestleMania, especially if you hadn't been to a ton of other shows, it really is something special.
Yeah, and it even felt surreal watching it last night, because I watched the Hogan Rock match last night, and with the Hogan's entrance being so much in black and white, it didn't even feel like it was the same event I was at.
Yeah, that's true. That is true. They did. They used the black and white special effects for the NWO entrance. But let's talk a little about Hogan and Rock and coming into this. So, to give a bit of background for anyone who's not aware, the NWO were, of course, a lethal dose of poison injected into the WWF by Vince McMahon himself, trying to kill his own company in February of 2002. They debuted on the No Way Out pay-per-view, apropos No Way Out, NWO, and they debuted, and they kind of just didn't do a huge amount on TV in the coming weeks until you had this segment with Hogan and The Rock going face-to-face, nose-to-nose, and it ending inexplicably with this weird angle where Rock was taken outside by the NWO and they ran him over in a truck, which I think people like to forget that even happened because it just seemed so out of place. I think it was enough to just have these two icons going at it one-on-one, face-to-face. That was enough to think. They had to kind of go overboard and cartoony with it. But I think they were able to kind of successfully kind of walk back on that and make that less of the thing and just make it more. Because if Rock was in the position of someone who got legitimately like attempted homicide put upon him by truck, I think he would be a little more fired up and wanting blood in the match than he was. Whereas he approached the match more as we'll talk about more, I'm in here with this icon. I'm going to test myself against him rather than I want to kill this motherfucker.
And maybe he's just so tough and made of iron that it didn't really faze him that much. Well, maybe he was like, I got this, you know.
Okay, well, Rock now, I think he could probably hit Rock now with a truck, and through sheer force of positive energy or just the fact that he's that jacked, I think he would probably come out unscathed.
Yeah. although he's not immune to some box office dismay, obviously. So.
Yeah, I believe Baywatch is not doing great from what I hear.
No, and apparently it sucks. So.
Yeah. Well, can't win.
But that being said, this did not.
No, this didn't. And I also rewatched it just now. And it really impressed me with how they were able to soak up what the crowd gave them on this night. And they came into this match, and I don't know if going into the pay-per-view, there was really the buzz about this being... Because Hogan was really seen as washed up at this stage, right?
Yeah. There really wasn't any buzz to me. It's not like we were going in expecting this to be like this highlight or anything like that. It was just, we were at WrestleMania. That was the draw. This match wasn't even announced when the tickets went on sale.
Yeah, that's true. And I think people were still kind of scarred a little from the stupid truck angle. So
yeah.
You had this kind of, it wasn't a match people were overly excited for, but the crowd, the majority of the crowd were, and the majority of the crowd wanted to make this something special. And you could tell that from the reactions before the opening bell even rang. And it was clear once the crowd were giving this match this kind of treatment, that's all Hogan needed.
Yeah,
even more so than Rock.
And one of the things is I find it's a bit revisionist to say that everyone knew it was going to go this way. I really don't feel like you could engineer this to go as well as it did with the crowd reaction.
At what moment in the match or even before the match did you start feeling, okay, there's something special happening here with this crowd?
The second Hogan walked out. As soon as he walked out, that place exploded. And because it was exploding, like, it got very contagious and it kept exploding more, and Hogan's reactions. And just the place was just completely vibrating. And then Rock came out and got all the boos and did that kind of look around, like, what's going on here? And that fed it even more. And it was astounding. I can't like watching it last night. The audio of watching it from the WWE Network just can't even come close to doing it justice. This was like the biggest wrestling moment I've ever been present for.
And that's really saying something, because generally WWE's audio is pretty great as far as capturing the atmosphere it shows. Mm-hmm. So to say that. Yeah, it obviously went beyond what television can capture.
Yeah, absolutely.
For you and your friends, you were there. Were you guys huge Hogan fans from the 80s and early 90s?
The guys who were there with me probably were. Me, if anything, I pretty much hated the guy.
Okay, so that's interesting. So I kind of have always felt the same about Hogan. Did you get wrapped up within the crowd, and were you going along with and being hugely pro-Hogan as this was happening, or were
completely.
You... Completely. Oh, yeah? Okay.
Absolutely. Totally. Yeah. I couldn't help it. Like, it was just so cool. Well, for one thing, it was the first time I'd ever seen him live. So that was one of the things, is I wanted to have the chance to see him live. And I'm so glad this was the chance to see him live. I mean, Flair was on the show. I'd seen him live once before. What's interesting with that is he faced Undertaker on the show. And the other time I'd seen him was in Sydney, Nova Scotia, when he faced Undertaker just after he'd won the world title for the WWF title for the second time. But anyways, this was my first chance to see Hogan. So it was cool for that. But just, I mean, I think he's always had a special relationship with Toronto. I hadn't been to a lot of shows in Toronto. I'd been to one WWF host show before this, but this was certainly the first time I'd seen this, and it was like a homecoming for him, because he used to be a big deal at Maple Leaf Gardens here. And it was like a homecoming with the WWF audience as well, because I'd like to think that Toronto is pretty emblematic of what the WWF audience should be. Even though Vince McMahon hates us.
It's always been a WWF stronghold, and even after years of being banished from having any major shows, when that Roblox show came to Toronto in 2015, I want to know, it was 2016.
No, it was 2016. Yeah, Stephen Graham and I were there.
Early 2016, when you guys got that show, and that crowd was so great. That had
yeah,
to play into what you guys got towards the end of the year with the NXT TakeOver Survivor Series double shot, which was, my God, those crowds in Toronto for both those shows were just amazing.
Oh, yeah, so, it was such, those were a blast. Those were
really
the best time I'd had at WWE in years.
It's such a testament to how great Toronto wrestling fans are that after being neglected for so long as they were, there was no grudge held. It was just like, okay, we're getting cool shows. We're going to make them great. So, yeah, it's a passionate fan base. And it was passionate about Hulk Hogan on this night. And he certainly knew how to take that reaction and get the most out of it, both for the match, but also for himself. So, at what point in the match did you start to see, okay, he sees an opening here to really make this the Hogan show and really do things to make it all about him, not even necessarily in a negative way or in a selfish way, just in
a
showman way.
He took the ball and ran with it, and I'd say, you know, just even from the opening interactions with Rock, it was just, this was something different. And, you know, I mean, you got to give so much credit to Rock, the fact that the most popular man in wrestling all of a sudden was able to turn on a dime and play heel and come out as a face at the end. Not to get ahead of ourselves with it, but, like, that performance is unparalleled as well. But, yeah, Hogan, just the whole thing, like when he fired up, when he hulked up, I actually got sucked in by that last night because it was just after a near fall, and I actually knew that he hulked up, but I'd forgotten about it and was so convinced that this near fall was the end, even though I'd been there alive, that I got completely sucked into the hulking up even last night.
Yeah, it was incredible. It was a rock bottom. He kicked out one and then went into full hulk up. And it kind of came out of nowhere. Like, obviously, the fans would have wanted and expected a Hulk up, because, like, that is Hogan's, like, main thing within a match. So you knew they had to be doing it at some point. But to do it straight out of the rock bottom kick out was so well done. And it really, really just set the place alight, because it just had the crowd go from a buzz to a holy shit, it's happening right now.
Yeah,
they didn't have time to prepare the reaction, so it came across even more natural.
I wouldn't have thought anything could be more powerful than when he came out, but that moment was, it even went to another level then.
It really did. And you mentioned Rock doing a good job here. We do got to give Rock credit, because he's talked about how this is like a learning experience for him, and how Hogan kind of like showed him how to, a lot of things about how to get over on this night. But Rock, he, like you said, he ended up a huge face at the end of this when they did the angle with the outsiders coming out. But even before the outsiders come out, when Rock won and he kind of stood with Hogan and put over Hogan, Rock wasn't getting any boos at that point. The crowd were into the whole thing. It was a whole big babyface moment.
They were even into the people's elbow in the pinfall. Like,
yeah,
they turned
right.
With that.
Yeah, they did. The people's elbow got a huge reaction. But at other times in the match, Rock was dealing with some pretty big boos.
Oh, yeah.
He grabbed Hogan, for instance.
It was amazing. And not to jump around too much, Alan, but a great coda to this is 10 months later, when they had Hogan versus Rock at No Way Out, from Montreal, and the next night I was there for Raw when Rock came out and did like the greatest heel promo I've ever seen, when he'd come back and turn heel and just he just shit all over Toronto. It was so great. And the fans wanted to cheer him because he was being the cool heel now. And he just he had the place completely under his thumb.
Yeah, that was Hollywood Rock with the leather vest era. That was I was a big fan of that iteration of The Rock, but I think this match was a big thing that played into the inspiration for that.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. It's just like it's cool to have been there and been a part of it. Like I feel like my cheering made a difference. It was that cool a crowd to be a part of.
Could you feel at the points in the match where Rock was getting heat, the strapping I mentioned with the weight belts, which was really, and the commentators even brought this up, it was an eye for an eye because Hogan did it first. He strapped Rock first, and Rock was basically just turning the tables on Hogan.
But interestingly enough, when you watch it, it seems like the fans are justified in booing him because there's something in the way he's whipping him even, where he's doing it like a heel. Does that make sense?
It does, yeah, because I think it almost was like when Hogan was doing it, it was this valiant old guy going out in his shield, doing whatever he can to stay in it and hopefully keep himself alive. But then when Rock got the belt off Hogan and starts doing with him with anger and fury and taking out his frustrations of what Hogan's been doing in this match, it just felt callous and unnecessary and cold. It was like, why are you whipping this poor old man? So Hogan, even though he was technically the heel going into this match, is this sympathetic babyface from pretty much, I would say, after the first opening minutes of Hogan bouncing the Rock around and getting huge cheers for kind of, he essentially had his shine, and then Rock got heat on him for most of the match. It was a traditionally worked babyface heel structure match in terms of shine, heat, a comeback. But it was the heel that was in the babyface slot, and the babyface was in the heel slot. And I don't even think it was necessarily planned to be like that. I think that's just how it developed.
Yeah, and it really transformed from being the crowd cheering the heel to Hogan was turned into a babyface. And, like I say, I know people say that they saw it coming, that the fans were going to cheer Hogan. But I don't think he could have foreseen this. Like, I don't think he could foresee just how well it went. I mean, you could think that, you know, like, you could see that Brett and Austin might have a good match, but it was hard to foresee just how well it would go. And this isn't as good as match as that. I'm not saying that at all. But this was as great a moment as that, as far as I'm concerned.
Was there any point in the match where, you felt it went down a notch in terms of, because that was one thing that surprised me. I thought, I haven't watched this match in years, I thought there would be points where it kind of gets slow and maybe uninteresting. I didn't notice anything along those lines.
No.
I thought they really kept up a good pace and had something interesting happening at all times from start to finish. Would you agree?
Yeah, I think it was just the right length. If there's anything I'd change with it, it would be after the match when, after they ran off the Outsiders and after they were posing. I think the only thing I'd change is that they went out to Real American.
Yeah, I think the crowd would have lost their shit for Real American because he came out to – what did he come out to again?
The NWO theme.
Just the normal standard
NWO. Did that sound just like it or
– It sounded perfect, Dave.
Yeah.
I don't know if you're aware, but there's a podcast, so I'll give them a plug here, Music of the Mat, on the Voice of Wrestling website. Have you come across this podcast?
No, I haven't.
It's really, if you have any interest in wrestling entrance music, I'm not a big entrance music guy, but in terms of like kind of historical knowledge of entrance music or collecting entrance themes, but this show is so well done that I think any wrestling fan would really appreciate it. It's so well edited, so well produced, and they basically run down the different wrestling teams fitting a different theme, overall theme, every show, And I imagine they go into the most minute detail of like the songs. They did one NWO episode where they went through all the different versions of like the classic NWO team and the B team, the Hogan Voodoo Child songs. So yeah, it's really good, and I really enjoyed that NWO episode.
I imagine they could do some WrestleCrap type episodes too, right? Like of William Regal, Steven Regal's Real Man music, yeah. That kind of stuff.
Oh, they absolutely should. Yeah, that's a great idea, actually.
Yeah, I really hope they've somehow mentioned Lex Luger's 1989 NWA music, because that's like my favorite entrance music ever. But that's a whole other topic.
If I had to say my favorite entrance music ever right off the top of my head in that era of WCW, I'm going to say Steinerized.
I'm sorry.
you can't beat a story about two brothers, Rick and Scott. what a start to a song as that is. But back on track here, yeah, I do agree with you. Real American, if it played, I think that was the one thing missing from the presentation that would have really taken the crowd the extra mile and just even made it even that bit more special. But I don't know actually even if the crowd did have more to give. I think they might have even hit a peak here with what they did get. So who knows?
But I think it says something about this match that it took Hogan and made him a credible world champion a month later. Because I don't think he could have done that a year before. But this match made him back into a main eventer, at least for a period of time. And made me like him as a main eventer. And not only that, I actually, one of the other codas to this is that I, a couple months later, got to see Hogan defend the WWF title against Flair when Flair had just turned heel on Raw when it was back in Toronto.
So. I'm trying to remember that. That was after Flair had control and ownership of Raw.
Yeah, right? That's when they'd done the brand split. Hogan, Vince had SmackDown and Flair had Raw. And Flair turned heel the week before. I think it's when Stone Cold left.
Yes.
And he turned heel and had, what's his name? Big Show with him.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and Hogan, I thought, was on SmackDown, though, right?
But at the time, there was only one unified champion, and they went back and forth between shows.
Yeah,
so he won it from Triple H, who then lost it a month later to Undertaker. But that little world title reign in there was pretty cool. It was his last one, actually. So
it was. I remember, like, I was. It can't be emphasized enough how impressive it was to make him credible as champion at that point, because I was 16, I want to say. So, 16-year-old wrestling fan, the least hip thing in the world to me was Hulk Hogan coming back. And I just thought, this guy was the definition of washed up. Like, there was no one more washed up that you could feel out there for me. I just thought, Hogan, okay, yeah, whatever. And then they did this match. And I'm not going to claim that I was all into Hogan then after this, but I certainly was like, hey, that was pretty cool. That was very, very cool. So it really was a testament to his performance that night, not just in terms of how he went with the crowd reaction, but were you surprised by his physical performance in terms of some of the bumps he took and taking all those rock bottoms and doing the leg drop, missing a leg drop?
Especially watching it back last night, knowing how bad his back was later, it's really impressive that he took so many rock bottoms. And, that he was bumping around for rock.
Because
he didn't do a lot of physical bumping during his WCW champion days.
No, he certainly did not. Yeah, I think that's probably one of the only reasons he lost the title to Lex Luger, because he could just go up in the torture rack. Dave, if I was to present you with the question of if you close your eyes and think about this match, either now having rewatched it or before now having rewatched it, is there a defining image that you think of when you think of this match? If you just close your eyes and think Hogan versus Rock, WrestleMania 18, Toronto Sky Dome, what image do you see?
You know what? I don't think they quite capture it in his entrance, and it might be because it's black and white, or maybe it's just the camera angle. Even though I was as far away as you are now, I did have the Titantron right next to where he was coming out. And just the reaction from Hogan when he came out, it seemed like he was going to cry. And like he was surprised by that reaction. And that's really what defines the match to me. It's like, because from then on, it was just on fire. You know, I could also say the look on Rock's face when he was looking around, couldn't believe the boos, and then maybe Hogan hulking up. But I'd say the entrance tops it all for me.
Okay, and the last question. After being there live, how much were you itching to rewatch it on tape? And how soon were you able to rewatch it on tape?
I got it on DVD as soon as it came out, and I watched it right away. I couldn't believe it. Like I was just buzzing for a week after this. I was so excited to have been there, and I couldn't wait to watch it back on tape.
Did you find, like you mentioned, that the atmosphere not carrying over, but still
it was
tape,
still it was still better than most
atmosphere.
Yeah, it was still better than most atmospheres, and you know. I think maybe it's the passage of time. Maybe it's how I was watching it last night. But it really gave me that nostalgia for having been there and just how cool a moment that was.
Out of curiosity, when you were rewatching it last night, did you check out anything else from the show? Because I skimmed around a few bits.
All I caught was a little bit of Christian winning the hardcore title from Molly Holly just before the match.
Yeah, I watched Saliva's full opening concert with the video up on the video screen, which they, in a sign of the times, instead of the classy, patriotic national anthem to open WrestleMania, they had this massive new metal concert with Saliva instead. So it was quite the difference from your standard national anthem opening. Well, I guess because they're in Canada, they wouldn't do the U.S. national anthem, but
no,
they probably
and
didn't want to do the Canadian.
I don't think Robert Goulet was going to come back and do O Canada either, so.
Was that what they did at WrestleMania 6?
That's, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I actually didn't think about that. They of course, weren't in the U.S., so it wouldn't make sense to do the U.S. anthem. But,
Drowning Pool played on it as well. Am I right about that?
They played the Dudley's team, because,
yes.
Yeah, I was flicking through, and I flicked through that tag match, and I was like, I don't remember this match at all. The Hardys against the Dudleys against Billy and Chuck. And let me tell you, Jeff Hardy looked worse for wear on this show. He was having some personal issues going into this. I mean,
yep.
As he looked kind of strung out and stuff, the thing that really got me worried, Dave, a wrestler showing up at WrestleMania without a WrestleMania tan, that is just concerning.
You know who was not looking worse for wear?
Stacy Keibler.
Chuck and Billy.
Those them two.
I loved that gimmick, man. And I was trying. I was being very careful on to say Buck and Chili. That's almost came out of me, but
was it chilly in Toronto that night, or was the weather pretty
cold? Oh, it was freezing when we were waiting outside. It was brutal.
Oh,
and
yeah.
We had to wait outside forever, and I don't know. Two girls were on their boyfriend's shoulders, and everyone started cheering for them to kiss, and they did. And then people started cheering. Let's just say they
so
started.
So
yeah, and then they started cheering, you know, for her to take her top off and started booing her. And like one of the guys I was with was like, "She just kissed her sister for you guys. What are you booing her for?" You know.
Oh my god, that so wouldn't happen in 2017.
No.
Well, it might have happened in 2006. I don't know. I'd say 2006 feels more like 2002 than it does 2017.
But yeah, absolutely.
In 2006 is when we're going to talk about, or is the match that we're going to talk about. It's when it took place, I should say. And we're going to talk about it in just a minute. But before that, we will take a little pause for the cause, and we'll be right back to talk about the second part of I Was There When in a match that Dave was at in Chicago in 2006. So we'll be back after this quick break, everyone. Stay tuned. All right, we are back. I'm here with Dave Musgrave. We are about to talk about our second match that Dave Musgrave was there in attendance for, a very famous match in wrestling history. He was there when Do Fixer and Blood Generation took their rivalry to WrestleMania weekend. They took their rivalry to Ring of Honor. They took their rivalry to the United States for the first time. This was the Dragon Gate Six-Man, the famous Supercard of Honor Dragon Gate Six-Man. I'll do a Rob Naylor here. 3/31/2006, throwing the date right at you. You're never going to forget it. What an incredible, memorable, famous match this was. So much to cover on this one. Dave, initial thoughts on your experience with this match?
So the previous match we talked about was the best moment I was ever there live for. This is the best match I was ever there live for. One thing that I will throw out as well is all the other Dragon Gate matches that weekend were phenomenal as well. So it was basically like this was 10, but they were all 9.5. So the whole weekend as an ensemble also works together well too. But this match was just something like It was a crowd that was as cool as the one for Hogan Rock, but in a different way. It was smaller, obviously, but it was just so in sync and so smart and just so passionate for this match that we were seeing. And these guys put on something that was just completely state of the art.
Now, you mentioned it was a full weekend packed of this stuff. There was a show in Detroit the night before this, and then
which I went.
Yeah, so I was going to ask.
Yeah, I made it to all three shows.
Oh wow!
It was an awesome road trip. It was one of the best weekends I've ever. It's the best wrestling weekend I've ever had.
Easily. Did you go to that Mania too?
Nope, skipped it.
You know, you're not the only one. I know quite a few people. Naylor is another one. I think Keith is. There's definitely a couple other people who I know who went to some of the shows that weekend but didn't go to Mania.
I was very disillusioned with WWE at the time, especially coming. You know what really turned me off was the Vince McMahon Dr. Heine skit. Like I just couldn't stand Vince McMahon for a while after that, and he was just too much a part of the show, and I didn't trust him with my money.
There was definitely issues with the build heading into that WrestleMania for sure. But there was not just ROH, there was an IWA Mid-South show I know that was very big that week.
Which I also went to.
Did you? I was going to ask.
We had to leave during the last match, which unfortunately we did because it was Chris Hero and Milano Collection AT, which was really cool. But I did see part of it.
A lot of people left during that because it was to make it to, I guess that would have been the second Chicago show?
Yep, that was the show that the Do Fixer Blood Generation match was on.
Okay, so the first Chicago show, the middle show of the three, yeah.
Oh, wait, no. It was actually, it was the afternoon of the second Chicago show.
Yeah, okay. So
my bad.
It was, as we mentioned earlier, that was really the first proper WrestleMania weekend show. There was a little bit of a one in 2004, but 2006 was the first one where you really got that full WrestleMania weekend experience. Well, nothing like it is now, but the first.
This was definitely the start of it.
Yeah, it was the first time you could go and attend a bunch of shows.
You could also say in some ways now is not quite what it was then either. I'm not going to say now isn't great, but it felt really special. Because it was so underground with ROH at the time, but still so. So just perfect. It was a perfect wrestling promotion at the time, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, there was definitely a specialness of those. I think I would say those 06 ones, the 07 ones of Detroit, and the 08 ones in Florida.
And I was at the 07 ones in Detroit as well.
Oh, man, you got to see some great matches. But I think it's no coincidence for me and my fandom that those 3 years I mentioned are the 3 years they had Dragon Gate guys in. And those Dragon Gate guys every year killed it at Mania Weekend. And following that, if you look at it, the next few years weren't as special, really, but if you're looking at what ROH did on those next few WrestleMania weekends versus what Dragon Gate USA did, I would say the Dragon Gate USA weekends were better because, again, those Dragon Gate guys really came to play at WrestleMania weekend. And now it's obviously gone in different directions.
Probably 2012 was probably the next time after 2007, 2008 that Ring of Honor had a stronger weekend again.
Yeah, or I actually wasn't at any of the Ring of Honor shows in 2012, but they had some real good stuff. It was just really far outside of Miami. I think that was the problem there. It was a hell of a weekend in Chicago. There was a lot of amazing things that happened. I remember I was here on the F4W website, and I was listening to the Adam and Mike Big Audio Nightmare. That they had just got that show going, and Adam was there. He's a Chicago native, so he was there for a lot of this weekend. You can go in the archives and you can pull out the March or April Adam and Mike Big Audio Nightmare and listen back to Adam talking about this match from 11 years ago after attending it. I'd say it would be an interesting companion piece to us talking about it now, because we're talking about this with 11 years hindsight of wrestling evolving 11 years on from that. And Adam would have been talking about it then, and Mike as well, talking about it then as it happened, with it being, as you said, Dave, state of the art and brand new. So I think that could be very interesting to listen to.
And probably before Dave Meltzer dropped 5 stars on it as well.
May well have been, and Keith, I know, did a Dr. Keith show before I was on here as a part of it. He did one recapping his experience that weekend, and I'll never forget him telling the stories of him hanging out at the WWE hotel, and I forget who it was. It was some WWF staffer that he ended up having some interaction with, or someone that went into the Hall of Fame or something. But Keith had these great stories that he told from his experience that weekend. So, yeah, great 2006 WrestleMania weekend audio that you can listen to right here in the archives at f4wonline.com. But we're going to add to it with our discussion 11 years on, having seen this match again and reminiscing a bit about what it was at the time. And Dave, as far as Ring of Honor goes, first of all, what your fandom was for that company going into this, how hardcore of a fan you were, how much these shows were circled on your calendar, and then also, after answering that, maybe tell us a bit about what your knowledge was of Dragon Gate going into this, and Toriumon before that, and if you had any experience with these guys that you're going to be seeing on these shows.
Ring of Honor, I got into a little bit in 2003. I ordered like 4 different shows from the first year of their existence. Then 2004, I started to hear rumblings about like the Joe Punk matches. 2005, I got my own computer for the first time because I didn't have a roommate anymore. And got into downloading through LimeWire, which I have no guilt over downloading Ring of Honor because I spent so much money on it since. Probably bought everything that I downloaded for free as well. Anyways, that's when I started getting really into it. And that led up to October of 2005. I went to my first live Ring of Honor show in Buffalo. The main event was Danielson defending the title, his first weekend of title matches, against Carino, and that was a really fun show. And then 3 weeks later, they were in Detroit for the first time, and that was a really good show too. It had Danielson defending against Sabin, had a really good match with Roderick Strong and Jack Evans, and I think they faced AJ Styles and Matt Sydal, and that was just a blast. And then I just got, I just remember coming back from my first show in Buffalo. And, it's embarrassing enough when you're going across the border and you say that you're going for wrestling. But then when this girl, and, you know, I was a single guy, she was a cute girl, you know, she asked me how much I spent while I was in the U.S. and I said $227. And she goes, "And what did you buy?" I go, "Just wrestling DVDs." And she's like, "You spent $227 on wrestling DVDs?" And I'm like, "I'm sorry." And she goes, "No,
Did you tell her that you got, like, Ring of Honor 4-for-3 at the merch table discount?
You know what? I don't think they had that yet.
Oh, if they did, I would have impressed her.
Yeah, I'm sure it would have. And she just was impressed. I don't know how it came to a number like 227, but I just remember saying that specifically. Maybe it was the exchange. But anyways.
Or maybe you bought some IWA mid-set DVDs from Ian, and it was like a barter system where, like, Ian, I'm not giving you the full 20 for this one, all right? $17, that'll do it. He went for it. He wasn't going to turn his nose up at $17.
And it made me – I felt okay to go for it because I knew that would pay for the hot dogs he was using as payoffs that night.
Oh, sick burn. I don't think Loki would have been paid in hot dogs for that night.
No, I don't think so. So, when I went to the Detroit show, actually, I met a guy named Brian Baranga, who I'm still buddies with. I'm not in contact with a lot, but I'm on Facebook with him. And we met then. We kept in touch a bit. And then we did the road trip together for Detroit and Chicago, and it was just a blast. We met all kinds of guys down there, including Matt, a.k.a. Shining Wiz, who you went to Japan with.
I did, yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So he was on the road with us that weekend. He was in the car with me and Brian when we went to IWA Mid South.
Oh, you know, I feel like he might have mentioned that to me last year. I
got in touch with him when you guys were over there, and it was really funny that you guys were doing that, and he and I had the trip, and he's from Nova Scotia as well, right? So
I think that was the ROH shows that he won a competition to be at, I believe.
He did, with Greg H.
Yeah. So, that was quite the weekend to be able to just take in all those shows.
And can I tell you who else traveled to shows with us? Jack Evans Sr.
Oh! Jack Miller Sr.
He's crazy. Really good guy. We were calling him Jack Classic, which anyone who's a fan of that era of wrestling would know what that reference is.
Was Jack even on those shows?
He was on those shows, yeah. He was, I just remember, like, I laughed at myself because I was having a shower, and I just realized I was far too into wrestling because I was in the shower just, you know, and all I was thinking to myself is, I wish I could break dance like Jack Evans. We all do. Yeah, we all wish that I specifically could break dance like Jack Evans.
Yeah. That is the dream.
Yeah, but he was on those shows, and specifically, he actually on the same night as the DG Six Man, it was him and Austin, I believe, against Seidel and Styles, and I was actually sitting with Jack Classic. And Jack Evans did the Space Flying Tiger Drop, and Styles caught him and did the Styles Clash on the floor. And the whole place goes nuts, and Jack Classic leans into me and goes, "I knew he was going to do that." And I was like, that just absolutely made my weekend. I was sitting with Jack Classic for the Dragon Gate Six Man.
It would have been nice to see Jack against Dragon Gate guys, but of course he ended up going over there later that year and getting very acquainted with those guys. But they were against each other on this night. It was the three Blood Generation members against three Do Fixer members. And these two teams, not these exact teams, but these two factions. Sorry, go ahead, Dave.
Yeah, you would actually ask my familiarity with them.
Yes, that's right.
I'd seen the Dragon Gate Challenge, I think was maybe Dragon Gate Invasion, I think, was the first show they did in Buffalo,
and it was
where Shima and Shingo came in.
Yeah.
And that's not the Buffalo show I was at. It was actually, I was at the next Buffalo show, which was the last one they did there for years. But so I'd seen that, and I'd seen a little bit of Toriumon, but it wasn't really my thing when I watched it. It would have been years later if I'd catch cut. If I went back and watched it now, I'd probably like it, but I didn't quite get it yet. I was just getting into Puro. But so really, other than Shima, and knowing who Dragon Kid was, I didn't know any of these guys.
I don't think you were the only one, because I think the vibe in that crowd, correct me if I'm wrong, was that you had, say, I don't know, 1,200 people there, right?
Yeah, 1,000, 1,500.
Yeah. Okay. So you had those people, I would say 90% of that crowd had some maybe awareness of who these guys kind of were, but were not avid watchers of what they had done. But
yeah, and the good thing is
support them.
And the good thing is that the ROH wrestling message board that was both a haven at times and a cesspool at others at that point, someone had done a really good post just kind of giving a summary of who each guy was. So people knew about Horiguchi and knew to chant H-A-G-E.
Yeah.
And some of the people who were there knew about that from the night before as well. So it got really contagious.
Yeah. And Ryo Saito is the best cheerleader ever leaving fans on. But I think that's really cool that, like, you had that many people in the crowd who may not have been overly familiar, but still wanted to respect and treat these guys like a big deal. I don't know if that would always be the case now. I could be wrong, but it seems like there seems like for Japanese wrestling in particular, and Japanese wrestlers coming over to America, there is more of a reverence of them in the mid-2000s than I think there would be.
Absolutely, yeah. So, well, we've gotten so much of it since then, too,
exactly,
right?
Exactly.
Like, and people didn't think 6 months earlier than that you were going to see Kenta and Marufuji come in. And then not only that, but they had huge matches as well, right? So
yeah. And there was probably the Dragon Gate guys always, like, I've seen them in small shows in England, just absolutely have tear up match of the year candidates. They always bust their ass. But you'd have to think there might have been some professional competition between seeing what Noah guys had done in Ring of Honor a few months earlier and wanting to top that. But they certainly had the guys to do it, because in 2005, that was the year that Blood Generation formed and became like a super heel unit. And Do Fixer really took off as the big baby faces in the promotion, with Saito in particular having a huge run and getting a push that no one kind of ever expected he would get as a former kind of comedy undercard guy. And he was just on a tear.
Was he champion?
He was champion in 2005, but not coming into this match.
Okay.
So with this match, they had a huge Triangle Gate, which is six-man titles, a huge Triangle Gate match at the biggest show of the year in 2005 in July at Kobe World Hall. And it was the same Do Fixer team, but it was against Shima, I believe Yoshino, and Don Fuji, I want to say. Actually, I think it was Doi and Don Fuji. It's definitely Don Fuji, Shima, and then one of Yoshino or Doi. So it was a slightly different version of the match, but it was an epic, and many Dragon Gate fans still would call that their favorite Dragon Gate match ever. So coming in with an iteration of that match, it was, you could tell they were wanting to put their best foot forward, and they certainly did. And I suppose the first thing I would ask you, David, is just kind of, what were you feeling when you had seen the guys the night before, but on this particular night when you saw them come out and standing three on one side, three on the other, and you saw them kind of getting ready to do, because they'd been only against ROH guys the night before, but when you got to see and you kind of felt, okay, I'm about to see some proper Dragon Gate action, what were you feeling at that point in time?
Well, for one thing, I definitely felt that Blood Generation was the greatest heel faction that I'd ever seen, certainly live. I just couldn't believe how they just oozed heel charisma. And at the same time, I just couldn't believe like how it felt to see these guys in there and just being able to, you know, just knowing that they were about to tear the house down, which I was right about. One of the things I'd say is like, I mean, a lot of people will say about this match that Dave Meltzer gave it 5 stars because he never watched Dragon Gate. And so I'm sure they had
true, by the way, because Dave did watch. If you go back and read old observers, Dave watched. He wasn't an avid watcher by any means, but he certainly sampled some Toriyama and early Dragon.
Yeah,
things were.
It's just people are being contrarian when they say that stuff about him. As far as I'm concerned, and they're being uninformed as well.
So going into it, as I said, people might not have been fully aware of these guys and watched a ton of their stuff. So the ability for these guys to pop the crowd with moves and sequences they had never seen before, it was ripe for the pick, essentially.
It was just amazing how they were able to just completely read the crowd and lead them into like this communal experience that was like that crowd. Like they rose together at the right time. They sat together at the right time. They cheered together at the right time. They did everything perfectly together.
And it's quite the, for such a different match to Hogan Rock.
Yeah.
What you said there about the crowd, actually quite similar.
Yeah, totally.
Communal sense of one feeling in the whole crowd, which is so rare in wrestling, to have a full crowd feel the same way, and you get it with both these matches.
Yeah, and it's like they when they started the "This Is Awesome" chant, it was at a time when that wasn't overdone, so it really worked well. And the favorite chant from this, I think anyone's favorite chant who watches it, and mine being there, was "Please Don't Stop."
First time it was ever chanted.
Yeah, and it was such a legitimate feeling, and then they did stop, and it felt right that they did.
Yes, they did. We'll get to the punctuation that was the end of the match in a sec, but just to talk about some of the things they did and why I feel this works so well. So I had been watching Dragon Gate for a little bit before this, and obviously since the 11 years,
You might have caught a little bit, yeah.
I've caught a show or two. I've watched my fair share. So for me to go back and watch this match, which is these guys doing spots that they did in a million other matches that I saw at the time, and spots that have been taken on to new heights in the future and done in more interesting ways, faster ways, more dynamic ways, etc., etc., etc. This still works. It still holds up perfectly because it's not.
And I think I'll clarify, we both watched it last night as well.
We did, yeah.
Yeah.
It's not about so much what they're doing, but it's about the pacing. It's about how they react to what they do, how they react to how the crowd reacts, and just how they kind of move it along and keep it going and keep it so that it's not like sometimes you'll see crazy kind of spot fest matches on the indies now, and they do some crazy stuff, crazier stuff that's in this match.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
There's a lot of setting up of an uncertainty and the kind of stuff that takes you out of the flow. At this, there's no moment that takes you out of the flow because these guys, Please Don't Stop, they didn't stop during this whole match. And it speaks to how comfortable they all are with each other. There's no uncertainty. It's just full on going for it the whole way and knowing when to take a different turn, knowing when to switch things up.
Just and
perfect
one
timing
of the
on everything.
Yeah. There's two comparisons I'll make. I know you, when you had Dylan and Justin Shapiro on to talk about the Shield, one of you made the comparison of it being like, these guys must be really good at Tetris because they seem to be able to fit things into the right place, and that very much fits here. And so does someone I know knew went got to see Wayne Gretzky play hockey, and he said the only way he can describe it is that he was always in the right place at the right time, and that's with these guys this night. They were always just in their perfect spot to do the next spot and to be out of the way for another guy to do his spot.
So watching it live and then rewatching it last night, two questions. One, was there any guy in particular you maybe you've mentioned and you seem pretty decently, but of the other guys, was there anyone that stood out to you when you first watched it as a real sort of surprise in the match in one way or another?
Yeah.
And was there a spot or a sequence that really stood out to you, or at the time, or even last night, made you go, holy shit, that was incredible, or that was not something I was expecting?
It's Dragon Kid, for sure. And what's fascinating about that is that I remember him standing out as, like, the star of the match, and then I read later that when Dave wrote that the guys went in, Blood Generation went in with the idea of making him shine. And it's just so amazing that with so many moving parts in that match, they could, you know, pick out a crowd that in the crowd that they didn't know, pick out one of the six guys to make look like the star. And it worked. What really, when he did his, what's that thing where he twirls all around the guy and does into the armbar, where he basically does a couple of rotations of it.
Deja vu.
Yeah. Oh, deja vu. That's it.
Christo is actually the one. Your deja vu is the one that ends in the DDT.
Okay, yeah, so that's what I'm thinking of is the Christo one. That we'd gotten to see the night before, so there was the anticipation for me, and he just executed it perfectly here. And that, and a lot of the random spots that he did, he hit them perfectly. And you know what? Ryo Sato had one of Blood Generation on his shoulders on the turnbuckles. And Dragon Kid climbs up to the top rope and does a Rana off of Saito's shoulders. And then what's great is that Saito follows it up with a top rope splash. And he easily could have done, you know, like some kind of like triple Phoenix corkscrew twisting senton or something like that. But he just did a simple splash. It was effective. Didn't try to show up Dragon Kid. Just did something that was logical and effective right afterwards. Yeah, that was awesome. I feel like Chris Farley here, but
the stack of perk around is actually hilarious. I got a real kick while watching that spot last night because that's literally every Dragon Kid tag match I've seen in the last 11 years. That spot happens in. It's
awesome.
It's one of the spots. If you go to Dragon Gate, you're expecting to see that spot. It's just always So it was so funny for me because like I. When I see it now, it's like I don't even think about it twice. And the crowd, like the Japanese crowd are so awesome because they just, like, they treat everything as such a shoot almost in how they react that even though they've seen it a million times, they're always going to give a good reaction to that spot. But it wouldn't be a reaction of shock and awe. But last night watching the Ring of Honor crowd react to it, it was a reaction of shock and awe, and it made the spot feel kind of crazy to me again after it being so just run of the mill for me.
More commonplace,
yeah. Yeah, it was really cool seeing it get that reaction last night.
And what was amazing with it, too, is that it was just the right side of being too set up. Like, you know, if he'd had it taken much longer, it would have just seemed like, oh, yeah, the guy's sitting there waiting for him to do it. Not like, oh, this is like he's actually pulling it off. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So that was an amazing spot. And, just even like, you know, they were just going so full pace. And then he just does the springboard Hurricane Rana to get the pinfall at the end.
No,
I
will correct you, Dave. The springboard Hurricane Rana was actually a big near fall.
A few
minutes later, it was the Dragon Rana from the top rope.
That's right, yeah.
Was the one that finished it off. The Dragon Rana, which he had not used in a few years to this point, and then didn't use it again for a few years afterwards. Ricochet was a guy that came in that was able to take that move beautifully, and they did it in their two big title matches that they had in Japan in 2012, 2013. So not a move that early in his career, it was like his main finisher. He'd use it a lot. And when he was working Sua, like every night, Sua would always take that move.
Those must have been great matches.
Oh, yeah. Oh, Dragon Kid Sua. Those two had some serious chemistry. Since his early years, it's a move that's really become protected. And it was the fact that they broke it out here shows that they really were treating this as a big deal for them and their exposure.
Yeah. And, I can't even believe I got to see this match live. It gives me goosebumps just thinking about it now.
A big thing with this match is where it goes from the crowd. Again, I'll bring it back to that thing with the 90% of the crowd that wanted to support it but weren't overly familiar. So for the first 10 minutes of the match, you have polite applause, positive support, no heckling. The crowd isn't dead. They're reacting to things, but it's not like, holy shit, we're losing our mind. But that's because the wrestlers in the match, they knew what they were doing. They weren't trying to have, holy shit, let's lose your mind.
No, they were drawing you in.
This thing, they drew them in. That's exactly the way it is. They drew everyone in. They built it slowly and built it to crescendo. This is a perfect example of a wrestling match and crowd reaction where it goes up as a straight diagonal the whole way from starting at the lowest point and ending on the highest point. So well done. The moment where things kind of start to go crazy, you see the whole crowd rise to their feet, is right at the sequence where basically everyone does something at a really breakneck pace, and then
yeah.
It ends with a big near fall, and then the crowd are like, oh my god, and they just all rise together, and then on the home release, that's when Dave Prazak shouts, Lenny Leonard, this action speaks for itself, and then you don't hear the commentators then for the rest of the match, so they go the last 10-12 minutes with no commentary.
And last night when I watched it, I didn't even notice till the end that they'd stopped talking because I was so into the action.
Yeah, they did. It was something they did at, I believe, the Punk Joe 2 match. They stopped talking towards the end, but then Joe Kobashi, they never talked.
Yeah,
that's without commentary for the whole match. But which I always thought that taking away the commentary was, because of how little they did it, it was a really effective tool.
Yeah, it felt special.
Yeah, it was very, very cool to do. Because they were there for the first half of the match to kind of set the stage for who the guys were, what the situation was, introduce them.
Which they did so well as well. Like, I mean, just explaining the HAGE, explaining that Yoshino is like the fastest guy you'll ever see. And
What was that like?
Oh, it was incredible. I was like, what kind of athlete is this guy? Where did he come from? I mean, I know one guy that you said is like one of the better athletes you've seen is Shane Haste or Mikey Nichols or whatever their names is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Whatever his name is now that WWE's destroyed him. But,
His knees have destroyed him. He's unfortunately laid up.
Too bad.
I think it was the Toronto show, wasn't it? Where they faced.
Yeah, they were good there. Yeah.
Yeah, and then it was right after that he got injured and Nichols was kind of hanging around until his partner gets back, I guess.
Yeah. But yeah, just seeing like such a superior athlete like Yoshino being able to move fast. And not only that, it's not like he was a pony doing tricks or something. He was like using it effectively. It was that's something that I would describe to people and try to help them understand. That's something I could show to people to try and get them to help understand why I love this stuff so much. Ring of Honor is all I was watching at this point, by the way. I was cherry picking any WWE I watched.
Well, then that brings up a question. Did seeing this make you want to check out more Dragon Gate?
Yeah. And I started watching Infinity a fair amount, especially to see some, you know, see like Jack Evans over there.
Yeah. I think that a lot of people did that.
Yeah. And I think I remember seeing within the next year of this, I remember there was a world title match with, Don Fuji was champion around this time.
Yeah. Yeah, late 2006, I think.
Yeah, so I remember watching a title match with him against Yokosuka before Yokosuka came in for the next year.
Yeah.
And, so I was watching that kind of stuff for a while there. And, you know, I really probably should go back and revisit some current Dragon Gate, because I'm assuming it's pretty good.
They have got one hell of a roster of young guys at the moment. It's there's this kid Yamamura who is going to be seriously special. He's already just, he's become like the most popular guy at Cork and Hall. The crowd at Cork and are just so into him.
That's awesome.
Here. But so it's actually something I've never thought of before. But when you bring it up, it kind of is interesting to me that you started watching some Dragon Gate following this in 2006,
yes,
and with the connection of seeing guys like Jack Evans there, Roderick Strong was there for a bit, seeing how those guys would fare and watching those infinities, I'm sure you weren't the only one.
No.
I'd say a lot of people took that kind of road into Dragon Gate, and I had started a little bit before, so I had a kind of connection to the 2005 stuff as my kind of entry point. And 2005 was awesome. That's one of the best Dragon Gate years ever. Their first kind of full years.
Really? Production. Yeah.
Yeah. 2006, for me and my whole time following Dragon Gate, is one of the weaker years they've had. There's a lot of not-so-great stuff in 2006. There's a Sima Gamma feud, which is never-ending and terrible. There was heel referee shtick that they were doing a ton that got really old. And I wonder if it was a better product that year, would more of the people coming in from RH to check it out have stayed around? Because those that did stay around through into 2007, spring of 2007, things really got good again. And 2007 onwards, I haven't had a period where I've been down on Dragon Gate since. So I'm a full 10 years now into never stopping watching Dragon Gate and not even considering stopping watching Dragon Gate.
Yeah.
It's well, always delivered for me. And I wonder if 2007 stuff was happening in 2006, would more people have become huge Dragon Gate fans? It's something interesting to think about.
And, you know, they probably had a heavier presence in Ring of Honor in 2007 with Shingo having had his run there, and then they did a fair amount building up. You know what really would have helped in 2007 is if Mark Briscoe didn't get injured in that match against Shingo and, and was it Shingo and Naruki Doi?
Shingo and Doi, and I saw them win the tag titles in Liverpool a couple weeks before you got to see them in Detroit.
Yeah, and my wife was there with me. It was the first Ring of Honor show I'd ever taken her to, and someone almost dies. And the problem is we were on the opposite side of the ring from them, so we couldn't see that he was even alive. So we had no idea what was going on. So
there was the awkward thing with the Motor City Machine Guns coming out to challenge the Briscoes after, but everyone's worried about Mark being dead.
Yeah. Yeah. And then she also had the pleasure of seeing the less than gentlemanly catch-as-catch-can match between Jimmy Jacobs and BJ Whitmer in a cage, so... Yeah, I did manage to get her to shows again after that, but it was a tough road to hoe.
Going back to our sixth man, again, I'll pose the question I posed earlier. If I get you to close your eyes and think about this match, what's the defining image?
I think probably when the match was over and just like them soaking in the roar of the crowd and just how, you know, you could tell those guys knew they nailed it. And I just remember the applause from the crowd and just them soaking it in. Everything else is just, it was so fast. It's hard to nail down one of the particular moments from it, but that is really what sums up the match to me, them getting the standing ovation and deserving it.
That's actually something that we should mention. It's like you're struggling to kind of come up with too many individual moments, and people would say, oh, they did so much you can't remember anything. You did a million things and you don't remember anything after, and so how good is it? But sometimes
I wouldn't say that's the case.
Sometimes it's the overall package, and it's not about individual things, and it's just, if you're able to think back to the overall feeling you had watching it from start to finish, that's as powerful as remembering a spot or remembering a moment in a match.
That stack up Rana that Dragon Kid did, you know, like I remember Yoshino kicking it in and starting to do his sprinting around the ring. You know, I remember these things clearly. And it's just, that was a great summary to the match, is that, yeah, that standing ovation at the end.
Absolutely. And then as well, the same question we had on the, oh, actually, sorry, that is just one other thing I was going to say. The Hogan, when you're talking about them soaking up the applause and everything at the end, we had Seema shake the hands of the baby faces and it be met with disapproval of his heel tag team partners.
Yeah.
Holy shit. Did that strike you as amazing that the exact same thing happens with Hogan and Rock, with Hogan turning face, shaking Rock's hand, and Nash and Hall coming out and being...
Yeah, that is pretty amazing.
Is that?
Yeah.
Because Joey and Yoshino, they really get on Seema, and they push him, and they're like, what's this shaking hand shit? And Nash and Hall, the exact same thing. It's crazy, actually, now that we think about it.
Which one's Hall and which one's Nash?
Oh, that's a good question. I think Yoshino is probably in terms of their two characters, Yoshino's the more level-headed of the two, so I'd say he'd be Nash. Whereas Doi, like, Doi's a bit volatile, he turns every 2 weeks. I'd say Doi is Hall.
Can I ask a stupid question? Both those guys are still kicking around Dragon Gate, right?
Doi is on a huge wave of popularity right now. I think he's probably going to be the main event at Kobe World this year and win the Dream Gate, and it will be a huge... he was last Dream Gate champion in 2009, 2010, so I think that will be a huge deal. He's super over as a babyface right now, and they're in a stable together. They're basically the two kind of veteran... Or they're still like in their prime, but they're like the two sort of veterans leading.
Oh yeah, they're definitely veterans,
guys.
Right? Yeah,
it's them with three younger guys in their stable, and
that's the way the wrestling stable should be.
Yeah, and Yoshino is an incredible story this year, one that's not getting enough coverage. After being like a guy who is like Mr. Take No Days Off, he's always going, never injured, never hurt, wrestling the exact same as you saw him in this match, but even better. He's become much better with psychology, and he's had some big, epic matches, which really tell great stories over the years. He's been one of the best Dragon Gate wrestlers of the last 5-6 years, but as I was saying, never missing a day. This turn of the year, one of the first shows of January, he broke his back, like proper broke his back. And it was very much thought that he might never wrestle again. Very, very concerned that he would never wrestle again. And he was back within 3 months.
That's crazy.
Months. He had his first match back after breaking his back. And unless you were a super keen eye, which in this case I will... As being someone who's watched this stuff for a long time, as far as Dragon Gate, I think I'm not tooting my own horn too much to say I'm a keen eye when it comes to Dragon Gate, but unless you have a keen eye like myself, you would not notice any difference with him. I have noticed that it's interesting that they've only had him, they've put his new group into a feud with the Jimmies, which is basically, two of the guys you saw in this match in Doofixer, Rio and Genki, and other guys from their kind of class, Susumu, Canis, Jimmy Kagetora, basically other veteran guys who Yoshino has been wrestling for the last 15 years that he's comfortable with. They're the guys who he's been programmed against since coming back. He's not wrestling any of the younger guys. He's not wrestling any of the bruisers to throw people around. I think he might be somewhat fragile, and they're being careful with it. But you wouldn't be able to tell because he's running around that ring as fast as ever, 3 months after a broken back. So, it's pretty amazing. But yeah, those guys are still doing very well. So, I was gonna just say then, the same question I asked you with the Hogan thing, how soon were you able to get the DVD, and when you watched this back, did it live up to, not yesterday when you watched it back, but when you initially watched it back, did it live up to what it felt like live?
Yeah, absolutely. It even, like I say, like watching it live, I'd seen so many great matches with the Dragon Gate guys that weekend that this stood out as the best, but not like the best by leaps and bounds. And it was when I watched it again, you know, in isolation, that I really realized how special it was. I showed it to my buddy that I was living with at the time who couldn't stand wrestling, just to try to make him understand what a 5-star match was. And, you know, Dave Meltzer's rating of it helped with that as well. It made me that much more excited for it, that I was there for one live. And the only one that I've been there for live that he rated 5 stars. So, it probably even got better when I rewatched it on video.
Okay, so with all that said, now I teased on Twitter yesterday, and I mentioned this to you in the DMs, Dave, that I had a major revelation last night watching this match that I want to share with everyone right now. So, watching this match, I obviously started thinking of a match that it gets compared to quite a bit, that being the barely legal 97 Michinoku Pro Tag in ECW, where you had, again, a 6-man tag, Japanese Lucha Wrestling guys coming in, crowd that was unfamiliar but wanted to be supportive to this foreign thing, and blew them away. And by the end of the match, they were freaking out over what they had just seen. So, these two matches, quite similar in that regard, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, absolutely.
And the Michinoku Pro match is kind of thought of as the match of the 90s as far as that phenomenon of guys coming in from outside of the US in front of a US crowd of hardcore fans who were unfamiliar with this kind of foreign thing and being blown away. They both fit that category. Michinoku Pro, the 90s one, the Dragon Gate 6-man, the 2000s one, right?
Yeah, they really fit well together as a companion piece.
Okay, so I was thinking about that, and I was like, God, we kind of really didn't have, or as of yet, we haven't really had that in the 2010s. We haven't had this decade's version of it. And then I was like, hang on. Yes, we have. We had it 2 weeks ago. Because this decade's version of the Michinoku Pro Barely Legal match and the Dragon Gate 6-man in Chicago was also in Chicago, and it was Pete Dunne versus Tyler.
Yeah, that's absolutely
NXT TakeOver.
That's absolutely true.
Pete Dunne and Tyler Bate is the 2010s version of the Michinoku Pro 6-man and the Dragon Gate 6-man, because that match had two guys that had not been in the U.S. They've obviously had a couple of matches in the U.S. on a few NXT shows, but they hadn't had a match on that kind of stage in the U.S. And in front of that crowd of, the NXT crowd is pretty much the equivalent of the ECW crowd in the 90s and the ROH crowd in the 2000s, right?
It's
hardcore fans of the time. And
it's the cutting edge fans. Yeah.
It's the cutting edge fans. And they were treated as something that, okay, so the most hardcore nerds in the 90s were watching Michinoku Pro. The most hardcore nerds like myself and these thousands were watching Dragon Gate. So we knew what to expect. And I've been watching Pete Dunne and Tyler Bates, so I knew what to expect. But that next level of fans, wave of fans in terms of hardcore fandom, they're cutting edge, but they hadn't seen the degree of, or they hadn't seen all of those guys to where those guys could come in and do their match. Like Tyler talked about on the Flash Morgan Webster podcast the other week, To him, it was just him and Pete having a match. It was just them doing their match. And to fans that have been following them over here in the UK and Ireland and Germany, we've seen what they can do together. There was not a huge amount in that match they did that we haven't seen them do together before. But for the most of the fans in that building, it was fresh. It was new. And seeing those fans react to it, and seeing Tyler and Pete play off their reactions and take that, oh my God, what am I seeing here reaction, and that moment where the crowd rise to their feet and start stamping, that moment in the Tyler Bate match was the same as that moment in the Dragon Gate Six-Man where Lenny and Dave Prezak stopped commentating and said this action speaks for itself because the crowd had just started going nuts. It was the same phenomenon. And that match is this decade's version of those two six-mans. And it just made me really excited to realize that. To think, like, I'm not the completist in myself, to realize we had that. And it has followed on so perfectly from those two matches. And, I think Pete especially, I know that's something that... He's a super hardcore wrestling fan, big tape watcher, always has been. I think
Pete Dunne is
oh yeah, huge. Pete Dunne, the Michinoku Pro connection, he went over as a teenager to Michinoku Pro to train in that dojo because it just the idea of it was hugely appealing to him. And
that's awesome.
Yeah. So it's cool to me that we had something. We might have another match like that, but I don't know if we will, because I think, I don't know, unless there's some guys from Japan that come over again before the end of the decade, because right now there's a lot of stuff happening in Japan that isn't really followed by hardcore fans in America, so there's the possibility that maybe some big Japan guys will come in and blow people away who aren't familiar with what those guys do, but I'd say it's unlikely, so...
Yeah.
I think we'll be waiting until next decade, and how exciting is it to think what it could be next decade, what guys it could be that are going to give us this next iteration of this amazing phenomenon that we've had since 1997.
Because when the ECW Michinoku Pro match happened, you wouldn't have guessed that something like Ring of Honor would existed. And when that match happened, you weren't going to guess that there was going to be a British indie scene explosion.
That's a great point, Dave. That is a great point. So yeah, what could happen in 2026 or 2027, we might not even be able to think about where it's going to come from, because it might be something that's not even on our radar yet.
And I think there's going to be other comparison points. One of the things that I threw out on Twitter, and it got liked by one of the guys, is I think you're going to see Keith Lee and Matt Riddle have the next, the equivalent to the next Joe Punk matches.
Oh, wow, yeah. That would be, I could definitely see those guys having, they're gonna have a big match coming up.
Yeah, especially if Gabe set out for it to be that, you know, like, I think they could really pull it off. Hats off to Gabe Sapolsky, by the way.
I'm gonna let a cat out of the bag here, Gabe. I hope he doesn't mind. I hope he doesn't think I'm speaking out of school. But Gabe said to me, we were talking about Keith Lee at WrestleMania weekend, and I was comparing him to a different wrestler and talking about how he was and wasn't like this different wrestler. And Gabe's like, no. The wrestler he is 2004 Samoa Joe.
Yeah.
It was 2003 Samoa Joe, he actually said. And he just said, watch how he sells. Watch how he carries himself. He's 2003 Samoa Joe.
That's amazing. Like, yeah.
God, you're right, actually. He is. And, so it's a very astute of Gabe to realize that. And, yeah.
I bet you feel silly for having compared him to Warlord.
Well, you know, like I thought, I just thought there was something there, like, you know, two big guys, but I guess not. Warlord, I don't think is doing too many dives to the outside.
No. Although I did like his big staff with the W on it.
Yeah, everyone did. It was great stuff. But I hope people enjoyed this show as much as
I had a great time, Alan.
Warlord's staff, and... I had a great time talking to you as always, Dave. And for anyone that is unfamiliar with you and enjoyed listening to you, where can they listen to podcasts you've done in the past and potentially again in the future? And what writing of yours can they read? Because I know you're a keen pro wrestling writer and you've done lots of great work of writing over the years and are still doing some to today. So let the people know where they can find more Dave Musgrave.
So what I'm most known for is my time doing the Wrestling Culture podcast with my good friend Dylan Hales. And we've been in touch and we're going to try and do another show sometime soon. And those are really some of the most fun I've ever had talking about wrestling is with Dylan. I personally think we've had pretty good chemistry and we've done something I think we've had something a little different than what other people have had, and it's a lot of fun. So you can just Google my name with Wrestling Culture and you'll find it. You'll find some of our old shows. Some of them are hosted at Place to Be Nation, and that's where I do my writing as well. I've been writing most recently a series on going back and looking at matches that have been rated 5 stars by Dave Meltzer, which actually ties in well to this show. I've got part 6 went up today, or the day that we're recording this, which is Wednesday. So that did go up, and that has a lot of All Japan matches on it. It even has the famous Shawn Razor WrestleMania ladder match. I also write some show reviews there. I reviewed the Chip Day Trevor Lee match recently, and I'm now writing for Place to Be Nation their weekly Ring of Honor TV reviews as well.
That is awesome. So plenty of Dave Musgrave for people to sink their teeth into if they want to. And with Dave, we hope to give sorry, go ahead.
Can I just throw what my third place match would have been for I Was There When that I think you would have marked out for?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah. It's one that you briefly mentioned on your show on your first, what was it, Brandon?
Quinn.
Yeah. I was there live because I did a lot of traveling for Ring of Honor at this time for Kota Ibushi versus El Generico in Chicago.
Oh, so good.
Yeah, it was such a great match. Yeah.
It was like an extended edge singles match version of their interactions in that four-way.
Yeah.
Really, really good.
So I just wanted to throw that in there as well. So.
Well, Dave, it was a pleasure having you on here.
It was a blast.
Everyone enjoyed the show. Thank you for listening. A quick few plugs from me here as well. As it is a free show, I must direct you, as I have throughout the course of the show at various points, to the archives here at fwonline.com. If you sign up, you'll get access to all the archives of all the radio shows going back to 2005. So you can listen to those 2006 shows where various members of the staff talked about WrestleMania weekend that year and this Dragon Gate six-man. All the old Wrestling Observer newsletters that are up on here, all the old Figure 4 weeklies, and of course all the current stuff, all the radio shows coming out every week, the Observer several times a week with Dave and Brian, or the Observer Radio, I should say, several times a week with Dave and Brian, my DKP show, which we try to have about a show every week or so, covering all kinds of different topics, and a whole host of other great audio shows here on the website, the Observer newsletter every week, so much more. And yeah, please do sign up. You will definitely get your money's worth. And I also have to just mention myself on Twitter at Alan4L and Fighting Spirit Magazine at FSM_editor on Twitter, where I have written some things I'm really proud of this year. One, which just came out in the latest issue, my look at if Daniel Bryan was to ever get back into the wrestling ring, what it might look like in terms of his style and in terms of how he goes about his business. And another article I have coming up in the summer, I think around July, which is I've just handed in, and it's something very near and dear to my heart that I think a lot of people in my age demographic, Dave's age demographic, I think those of us who are around in the 90s will very much appreciate and enjoy this article. So, yeah, please do check out Fighting Spirit Magazine, which is available on the different mobile apps and all that kind of technological stuff that I don't really understand. So you can get it wherever you are in the world. But, of course, more traditionally, if you are in the UK and Ireland, you can get it in Ethan's or W.H. Smith's on your newsstand. So that is all my plugs. So, Dave, thank you. you again, buddy. And everyone, yeah. Thank you for listening. We'll be back soon right here on GKB. Bye, everyone.
みんなに稼ぎ欲しいのは本当にそれだけ。そんなもんは後から。